so this morning, I want us to read Psalm 139, but to think about how deeply we need to be searched and to be known. We live in a world where we are not incredibly connected, even though we have the internet, even though we have Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram and every possible social media outlet. We're quite isolated. In fact, one of the most disturbing statistics is that about half of Americans feel lonely almost all the time. About half of Americans feel lonely almost all of the time. Now, that's a disturbing statistic, but what's true is that as people get younger, as we do the surveys, the younger you are, the more likely you are to feel isolated and lonely. So that means that someone who's 18 feels more isolated than a person who's 60, according to national statistics. And think about that for a minute, because the person who's 16 years old is far more connected digitally than anybody who's probably 65 or 70. Now, granted, there are some outliers there that skew that statistic, but let's just face it, that's just true. So what we're saying is that one of the things that we can draw from this is that the more connected we are digitally, the less connected we are IRL or in real life. I just looked that up this week. I don't know what IRL is. Right? I honestly didn't know what that meant. But, right, so what we find is that the more connected we are digitally, the less connected we are in reality. Now, the problem is that think about that. We claim that social media could connect us, but we know that that's not true. Social media is a platform for our polished profiles, right? That's why every time I take a picture on my phone, it gives me about 17 filters, right? And let's face it, I'm not young and handsome and skinny as I used to be. Right? And so, honestly, I need about 3 or 4 filters on every picture I take, particularly that has me in it, right? I want more filters, right? If I could figure out a way to filter it more, I would. In fact, if I could just find a way to filter me out of most of our family photos, I think they would be better, right? That's how it works, right? We want filtered photos, maybe I'm by myself in this, but I know the exact angle to take a picture of myself. Have you ever noticed that almost every photo looks like they're looking down on you? Am I the only one that does this? Because I look better from there. I don't know why. I look better from there. And I know the exact angle that my photo should be taken. Right? You all look at me like I'm crazy, but you do it. I've seen your photos. Everybody's like, not me. And I'm like, whatever, I've seen them all. Right? We know the angle we need a selfie at. We all know that. We know what filter we use. That's why those wonderful sepia tones exist. Right? We do. Right? We have polished profiles. And that's what social media is. It's a platform for our lives. It's a platform for us to convince the world that we're happier than we are, prettier than we are, and better than we are. That's why social media, it doesn't connect us. Because we've curated this image of ourselves, and that's what we present to the world. And you might say, well, you know, human beings have perfected this, right? This is all brand new. Of course, it's not brand new. When we read the story of the Bible, the story of the Bible begins with human beings in a garden, right? Human beings are in a garden, and the Bible clearly says it doesn't waste words. The Bible says that they were naked and they were unashamed, right? They had nothing to hide from each other, not even their bodies. Their bodies were naked, and they didn't need to hide. There was no cellulite in the Garden of Eden, I guess. I don't know. No beer bellies. No, nothing like that. Or if they were, they didn't care. I don't know. I don't know exactly how it works. But they had nothing to hide. And as soon as human beings sin, the first thing they do is hide from God. And the second thing they do is make clothes for themselves so they can hide from each other. You see, they were doing Snapchat in the Garden of Eden because they began to clothe themselves. Psalm of David, and he begins by saying, you have searched me. You've done this. You've searched me, and you know me. You see, the greatest need that human beings have is to be known. And being known, to be loved. It's the greatest. It's what God created us for. God created us to be known by him and by each other. He created us to be known, and he created us to love and be loved. That's what he created us to do. Right? But we've broken all of that. Is that broken by our sinfulness, by our hiding ourselves from each other? And what does the psalm says? He says, God, you have searched me, and you know me. But let's talk about what this knowledge looks like, because David, you know, this is poetry, right? This is a song. So David's not content to just say, you know me. He says, listen to this. He says, you know when I sit down and when I get up. He says, you perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my when I go out and my lying down. And the word going out is the word that means to wander around. You discern everywhere I go. And before a word is on my tongue, O Lord, you know it completely. You hem me in behind and before. You lay your hand on me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty to attain to. That's knowing, right? God knows. He knows where we go. He knows who we are. He knows when we go to bed and when we get up. I mean, it says, you are familiar with all my ways. And he doesn't just mean like when I get up and go to work or when I get up and, you know, but he knows that my ways are what my life consists of, my lifestyle, my morality. You know everything. In fact, it doesn't even in there. He says, you know the intentions of my heart. He says, you know when I sit, in verse 2, when I sit and when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar. The word thoughts there is the word that means desires or intentions. This is what's really strange. God knows not just who we are in our lives, right? He doesn't just know that what we do when we're by ourselves, right, when nobody else is looking. But he knows what we want to be. He knows what our intentions are. He knows what we'd like to be if the world were perfect or fair or good. God knows he knows my intentions. And God knows that my intentions often do not play out in my life. But God knows even those. I love what he says. He says, you, before there's a word on my tongue, you know it completely. Before I even say what I'm going to say, you know what I'm going to say. This is real knowledge. God knows you. Now, here's the thing. In our marriages, in our relationships, there's probably only a few of people that really, truly know us. Right? Our spouses know us. Our children know us. And if you ever want to find out what a preacher's really like, if you want to know what my faith really looks like, then you talk to my kids, right? Because you see the part of me. I can be nice for about 3 hours on Sunday. But that's about the extent of it. About 11:45, I'm running out. Right? Don't talk to me at 12:01. I'm done. It's hard to be nice for that long. And my kids, they know. Right? But let's face it. There are even parts of me that even my wife and my children don't know. Not because I'm hiding everything, but because very often there are things about my split into three parts to talk about how God's relationship to us. It begins with his knowledge. From 1 to 6, it talks about how the word knowledge is used over and over and over again. God knows us. But God doesn't just know us, he's also present with us. Right? In verse 2, it says that you know my thoughts from afar. Right? God thinks God's, he's different than us. He's not a human. He knows our thoughts, but he's also present with us. In verse 7, he says, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, Sheol is the place where dead people go, right? Not bad people, all dead people. Not bad and good. It's just all dead people go there. If I make my bed in the depths, that's where you are. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, and if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me and your right hand will hold me fast. See, God's present with us. Not only does he know us, but he's present with us. And the idea of God's presence is incredibly important in the Old Testament, right? Actually, in the New Testament as well. But in the Old Testament, God consistently tells everybody he's with, he says to Moses, I am with you wherever you go. To Joshua, do not be afraid, for I am with you wherever you go. To the people of Israel, he gives them this thing called the tabernacle, which eventually will become the temple. Right? And the tabernacle is just like a portable temple, and it can follow them wherever they go. And the tabernacle is God's presence. When God creates the tabernacle in the temple, what he's telling his people is, I am here with you. I will be your God, you will be my people, and I will dwell in your midst. I will live with you. I'm not far away, I'm with you. But the temple wasn't enough. Jesus will tell us the temple wasn't enough. And do you know what Jesus' name is? Well, one of his names, he's got a lot of names, right? Prince of Peace, all that stuff, right? He's got tons of names. One of his names is Emmanuel, which in Hebrew means God with us. You see, Jesus keeps talking about, in the Gospels, Jesus keeps talking about how the temple was surely a wonderful sign of God's presence, but now we don't need the temple anymore because God himself has come. Jesus himself is God with us. That when we see Jesus, God is with us. God is with us. Presence of God is so important. He said, even in verse 11, if I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become light around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for the darkness is his light to you. The Gospel of John begins this way. In verse 5, he says, when he's talking about Jesus, he says, the light shines. David knows a thing or two about walking in the darkness. His life, in some ways, was charmed, but in other ways, it was difficult. He was anointed to be king of Israel, but for a decade or two, actually, he wasn't actually king of Israel. Right? There was already a king of Israel. His name was Saul, and Saul was a bad king, and Saul didn't want David to be king, as you might imagine. David had spent a big chunk of his life hiding from Saul in the darkness. And listen to what David says. He says, if I say, surely the darkness will hide me, the light will become light around me. But even the darkness is not dark to you. Because he knows God's presence. He knows that God's presence in the darkness. In fact, scary part, probably when those two little girls are standing in the hallway, right? That's the scary part. That's enough. Or that lady in the cup. That's enough. Right? And so what do you do when you're scared? You go into your parents' room. And I remember going in my dad. He was asleep. And I love my dad's bed. He didn't even talk to me. I just said, "Dad, I'm having nightmares." I didn't tell him that I'd watched The Shining. But my dad just pulled the sheet back and he let me get in bed. Why? Because I didn't need an answer to why there's evil in the world. I didn't want to have a philosophical discussion with my dad. I wanted his presence. Because his presence could cast out the darkness. That's what David believes about God. That God's presence is enough to make the darkness light. In verse 14, he says, "I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made." The word "wonderfully" there means distinct. And the idea is that what David says is that God spent a little bit of extra time on me. Now, David's not saying, "Hey, I'm special." What he's saying is, God spent a little bit of time on you, extra time on you. God spent a little extra time on you. God, each one of us are fearfully distinct. That we're not just carbon copies of each other. I mean, God could have just said, you know, God could have made me look like Brad Pitt, and many of you are wishing he would. But no, God said, "I want you to be different. I don't want that. I don't want carbon copies. I want distinct beings." And that's what the psalmist says. David says, "I'm not like my brothers. My brothers were all tall and handsome. But David was the small. He was the runt of the litter." God could have made tons and tons of copies of the good ones, but he instead made me. He made you. You see, he says, "Your eyes saw my unformed body." It's actually the Hebrew word that means like embryo. It said, "Even when I was in a clump of cells, you saw me. All the days one of them ever came to be, but God was already writing my life story in his book before they ever were. Jeremiah, one of my favorite prophets, he says this. It's the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, and this is in chapter 1. He says, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. Now, Jeremiah's going to struggle with this distinction. He's called the weeping prophet. But what we do know is that God, before your days were born, God was already thinking about you. In fact, listen to what he says. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. That God was thinking about me, and as he was making me, he was thinking about what I've become and who I am and what he longed for me to do and how he would like for me to change the world. He says, were I to count all your thoughts, they'd be like the grains on the seashore, of sand on the seashore. It's too many. I can't take it. I can't take all of it. Take it all in. Us. He's present with us, and he uses his creative craftsmanship for us. Now, this next verse, you're going to think that, man, the Psalm of David here really takes a turn, right? He says, if only you, oh God, would slay the wicked. You're like, many of you are like, let's just skip over that part. Right? Have you ever been reading this Psalm? It's a beautiful Psalm. You're like, oh, Lord, oh, yes. And then he goes, oh, if only you, oh God, would slay the wicked. You're like, let's skip. How about 23? We just go straight to 23. But here's the truth. David, listen to what David says. He doesn't ask God to slay his enemies, David's enemies. He says, I want you to slay your enemies. He says, if only you, oh God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak evil. Speak of God with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. And he says, don't I hate those who hate you? I have nothing but hatred for them. Your enemies, God, have become my enemies. Now, this is entirely inappropriate, particularly in the ancient world, but it's even now. Think about what David has just been talking about. He says, God, you created us as human beings. You created each one of us distinct and fearfully. You wove us together. He used the word, he says, you embroidered my life. That's the word he uses in when he talks about how he so we're